topic number two. Last month, in audio letter 34, I explained the long-term significance of the Battle of the Harvest Moon. This was history's first true space battle, fought in secret late last September. It ended on the day of the Harvest Moon, September 27, 1977, in a crushing defeat for the United States. As I told you last month, the Battle of the Harvest Moon was a turning point battle, like the Battle of Midway between Japan and the United States in World War II. And within hours after the space battle ended, Washington, D.C. was jumping with reporters because Soviet Foreign Minister Andrei Gromyko had arrived at the White House for a rare late-night meeting with Jimmy Carter and Secretary of State Cyrus Vance. The meeting, which came as a total surprise, had been demanded by Gromyko and had been granted instantly. This was the meeting that was described by breathless network reporters as resulting from a breakthrough, quote-unquote, in the SALT II negotiations. But when I recorded audio letter 26 just 3 days later on September 30, 1977, I told you the truth. Gromyko had demanded the late-night meeting at the White House to deliver a Soviet ultimatum in the wake of the Russian upset victory that had just taken place in the Battle of the Harvest Moon. As I told you then, all the reports at that time of an alleged SALT breakthrough were complete and deliberate lies on the part of the government and the controlled major media. Today, 9 months later, there still is no SALT II agreement. We, the public, are supposed to have forgotten the cover story about a breakthrough 9 months ago. Instead, now we are hearing about long deadlocked SALT talks, and early this month about reports of a freeze on the talks by the Carter administration. The turning point space battle of 9 months ago was the starting gun for a rush of military surprises since then. These I have revealed for you month to month, and now America's military predicament in any war to come with Russia will be untenable. Man-made catastrophe of unprecedented proportions is descending upon us, ranging from geophysical warfare to the beam weapons of Soviet hovering platforms called cosmospheres. As Alexander Solzhenitsyn put it in his speech earlier this month, quote, "A hundredfold Vietnam now hovers over you," unquote. Without a clear recognition of our true plight, there's no chance that it will be dealt with successfully. But our secret rulers got themselves and us into the present horrible situation through lies, secrecy, and manipulation. And now they see no way out for themselves by telling us the truth. After all, they have for nearly two decades kept secret the ultimate military purpose of America's moon program. So how can they tell us now? How can they tell us that the moon flights did not end in 1972 as advertised? How can they now tell us about the secret American moon beam weapon base in Copernicus crater, which was knocked out last September? And how can they tell us of the grave threat we now face? How, indeed? Having opened Pandora's box, our secret rulers long ago unleashed forces which are now beyond their control. And instead of admitting their misdeeds and so giving the United States a chance at survival, they are embarking on an all-or-nothing kamikaze plan like Japan in World War II. After Japan lost the turning point naval battle of Midway with America, the Japanese military posture started downhill. From that battle onward, the eventual defeat of Japan at the hands of the United States was only a matter of time. In the final months of the war, Japan was backed into a desperate corner. The war was exacting a fearful toll by then, and yet Japan's overtures to surrender were not accepted by the West. In sheer desperation, the Japanese turned to an all but unthinkable plan of counterattack, the kamikaze. The terror of a kamikaze attack had to be experienced to be believed. Even the most war-hardened sailors and naval officers found them unnerving beyond the actual damage they did. Because every kamikaze plane was piloted by a human being whose ambition was to die in flames while destroying an American ship by crashing into it. Yet, as nerve-shattering as they were, the kamikaze raids were hopeless. They were the suicidal last gasp of a nation that had already been defeated. Today, our secret rulers are taking on the kamikaze mentality. Militarily, they can already see the handwriting on the wall in the aftermath of the Battle of the Harvest Moon. But they have backed themselves into a corner through a web of lies and deceit from which there is no escape. They know they have already lost, but they are closing their eyes to this unbearable reality. Instead, they are pulling out all the stops on the political and military machinery now left to them, hoping against hope that they will somehow win the conflict to come. In the realm of foreign relations, our secret rulers are performing spectacular acrobatics, brought about by their recent change of course. 4 months ago in Audio Letter 31, I revealed that Rockefeller doors are being flung wide open to Red China in a desperate effort to build up China as a threat against Russia. And now this campaign is coming to the surface. For example, in recent days, the Carter administration has given its approval, quote-unquote, to plans of our NATO allies to sell China militarily sensitive equipment that is denied to Russia, as if China is now a part of NATO. And just 5 days ago, Leonid Brezhnev number 2, the ceremonial double seen in public since the real Brezhnev died last January, issued a warning about the new China policy of the Carter administration. He said efforts are being made, quote, to play the China card against the USSR. This is a short-sighted and dangerous policy, unquote. And he added that we, quote, may bitterly regret it, unquote. Meanwhile, in connection with the so-called China card, Japan is being urged to hurry and cozy up to Red China and to rearm. To rearm is in direct violation of the Constitution that was imposed on Japan by the United States after World War II, and it is provoking intense debate there. At the same time, a complete reversal has taken place in the posture of the United States toward our NATO partners. For many years, the policies of the United States toward Europe have been designed to fulfill Henry Kissinger's forecast of a Europe dominated by the Soviet Union, since our secret rulers were then in bed with the Soviet rulers. But since the day of the big double cross last September, the Battle of the Harvest Moon, our secret rulers suddenly need Europe. So a NATO summit was held in Washington at the end of last month. Our secret rulers tried to extract pledges from our allies to close ranks against Russia, under Washington's leadership, of course, and to sweeten relations with Britain and France, a policy flip-flop to ease restrictions on the Anglo-French supersonic transport, the Concorde, was announced just 3 days ago. And just today, Senate Majority Leader Robert Byrd of West Virginia is to leave for Europe in an anxious effort to follow up on the NATO summit. But like everything else our rulers are doing now, the attempt now underway to patch things up with NATO is just too little and too late. Turkey, vital to NATO's southern flank, has just signed a treaty of friendship and cooperation with Russia. And West Germany, the linchpin of NATO, is already making its peace with Russia. Early last month, on May 6th, Leonid Brezhnev number 2 was in West Germany on a state visit. On that day, Brezhnev number 2 and Chancellor Helmut Schmidt signed a 25-year trade agreement, and this is only the forerunner of things to come. But the most serious of all the failures of our secret rulers concerning NATO is right next door in Canada. 3 months ago, I detailed the Soviet-French intrigues through which Canada is being prepared as a base for eventual invasion of the United States by the Russian Army. Early this month, on June 2nd, Canada expelled all United States fishing vessels from her territorial waters. It was just an echo of Russia's action last September, just before the Battle of the Harvest Moon. At that time, the Soviet Union abruptly expelled all European Community fishing vessels from her northern waters. The reason for Russia's action last September was military, as I explained then in Audio Letter 26. And the reason for Canada's action now is military also, because now the sea lift of Soviet troops and equipment to isolated landing points on the Canadian coastline is being speeded up. Prior to the Battle of the Harvest Moon space disaster of last September, the deliberate betrayal of friends and allies was part of the grand design of our secret rulers. As a result, their pathetic attempts now to patch everything up will not succeed. But they are in a dream world of their own now, and their kamikaze plans are forging ahead in the military realm as well as in foreign affairs. Late last month, for example, Navy Secretary W. Graham Claytor launched a campaign to convince the American public, if not the Russians, that we are well able to fend off the tremendous fleet of Soviet submarines. Speaking of the critical field of anti-submarine warfare, Claytor boasted, quote, "The qualitative edge that we hold over the Soviets in both equipment and personnel is awesome," unquote. And reports have been made public to paint the Navy's towed array sonar systems as a breakthrough, light years ahead of anything the poor, backward Soviet Union might have. And just for good measure, American undersea warfare specialists have been quoted to the effect that Russian subs are so noisy that they are easy to detect. But, my friends, the sheer numbers of submarines the Soviets can put to sea enables them to overwhelm NATO tracking systems. This they have proven on several occasions, as I've discussed last August in Audio Letter 25. Beyond that, the Russians are actually well ahead of the West in the silencing of submarines. For example, there are the Russian missile-planting mini-subs which have crept into our own territorial waters to plant underwater-launched nuclear missiles, which today are still there, waiting to be fired. These mini-subs are invisible to all of our sonar systems, both active and passive. In Audio Letter 16 for September 1976, I described these mini-subs, one of which had become trapped in Chesapeake Bay by a malfunction that killed the crew. It was a unique opportunity to learn how the Russian sonar defeating system works. But in Audio Letter 17, I revealed how then-President Gerald Ford threw away this opportunity. As for the full-size Soviet subs, many of the older ones are relatively noisy. But those built more recently have a surprise in store. Knowing that American submarine detection technology is built almost totally around acoustic techniques, many of the later Russian subs are equipped with what is called an artificial acoustic signature. Each of these newer subs employs the world's most advanced design features for the purpose of minimizing propeller and wake noises. But in normal day-to-day operations, they employ devices called cavitators that greatly increase the noise the submarine makes as it moves through the water. These are the noises that are detected by our passive sonar systems, including the towed array systems that are supposed to be such a decisive breakthrough. These noise patterns, or signatures as they are called, are being programmed into the computers that are the key to our new sonar systems. But on the day that nuclear war one erupts, all the Russian subs that are equipped with the artificial signature system will retract their cavitators. Then as they streak across the oceans toward the United States, They will do so in near total silence. And the slight noises that they do make in their wartime configuration will be unfamiliar and unrecognizable to our heavily computerized sonar defenses. The result, if the Russian technologists are right, will be the equivalent of a breakdown in our sonar defenses just when we need them most. Similar observations can be made in other areas of our military situation, such as the cruise missile which was demonstrated in public at White Sands, New Mexico, a few days ago. But, you may ask, what about our secret weapons programs? 2 months ago, I revealed that Operation Desktop has been reactivated. Under cover of oil and gas drilling operations at sea off the east coast of the United States, efforts are underway to plant a new fleet of super ICBMs in launching sites beneath the sea. Exxon, which is doing this work off the east coast for the CIA, spent incredible reimbursable sums in order to lock up large areas of the Baltimore Canyon area now being explored. But some of the other companies now drilling in the area are actually interested in oil, and so far they have met with disappointment. Early this month on June 2nd, Conoco announced that their first test well had turned out to be a failure. A company spokesman said, quote, "I'd call it a deep disappointment. We spent $4 million and drilled out there for 53 days, unquote. Meanwhile, the revived missile planting project is speeding up. Soon the Howard Hughes mystery ship, the Glomar Explorer, is scheduled to put to sea to begin planting CIA super missiles in the Pacific. As I have discussed in the past, this was the original mission for which the Glomar Explorer was designed. And now, the official explanation has fallen back to the original cover story as well. And that is that the Explorer will be testing undersea mining hardware and gathering manganese nodules from the ocean floor. Can you imagine? In Audio Letter 20 for January 1977, I described the capabilities and gave the exact locations of the original fleet of CIA undersea super missiles. Until their containment vessels sprung leaks and they were ruined one by one, these were by far the most awesome on Earth. If more should be successfully planted now, they will share the same dubious distinction. But it will not matter. As long as the missiles remain in their undersea resting places, they will be safe enough. They cannot be reached even with the particle beam weapons. But should they ever be launched, they will be destroyed as they rise from the sea, because hovering over the site of each missile, the Kremlin plans to have at least two cosmospheres. As soon as the CIA missile breaks the surface of the sea, while it is still moving slowly and an easy target, it will be blasted by particle beam weapons. And so after spending vast taxpayer funds and tremendous effort to implant the new missiles, our secret rulers will achieve nothing more than several mammoth fireballs at sea. Russia itself will not be scratched. Is it any wonder that the Kremlin refers to the Russian cosmosphere as the anti-war machine? But the most suicidal aspect of all in our secret rulers' actions now is the political aspect. Having decided that they cannot tell us the truth so that we can all work together, they reason that they must instead achieve utter rigid control over us all. And to this end, all their former plans for emergency and dictatorship are being reoriented toward a new end. The so-called Second American Revolution, proposed by John D. Rockefeller III, fizzled in its original form, but now it is being revived under new colors. Suddenly, as if everyone in America suddenly got the same idea at the same moment, the so-called taxpayers' revolt is erupting. The first American Revolution began over taxes, so it is being tried again with the goal of manipulating the American people into our own undoing over grievances which in themselves are valid. Already there is a drumbeat of calls for changes to the Constitution to limit taxes. And ultimately, the total dismantling of our Constitution is intended to turn into a new Bolshevik revolution. Nothing could be concocted that would more surely seal our doom at the hands of the Soviet Union. But that is what is planned. And at the supreme moment of crisis, when all are calling for an experienced hand at the helm, someone will be ready. He is preparing now for that moment. His name, Nelson Aldrich Rockefeller, shades of his 25th Amendment. As America sinks toward final destruction, modern Western civilization is being dragged along toward its termination. But why is this taking place? The answer was given 600 years ago by the great Arab historian Ibn Khaldun. It is all explained in his introduction to world history called the Muqaddima, recently translated and published by Princeton University Press. Arnold Toynbee said it was, quote, undoubtedly the greatest work of its kind that has ever yet been created by any mind in any time or place, unquote. In my very first audio book talking tape nearly 4 years ago, I chronicled the birth of an incredibly powerful family dynasty in America a century ago, the Rockefeller dynasty. By the beginning of the 20th century, their power had increased to the point where the original governing system of the United States was being supplanted by their control. Instead of a system capable of continual renewal and regeneration, our country became entangled ever more tightly with the destiny of a single dynasty. Today, this entanglement is complete. As goes the Rockefeller cartel, so goes America. But as Ibn Khaldun established over six centuries ago, the natural lifespan of all true dynasties is approximately 100 years. This happens because in the course of three generations, the original qualities of toughness and group feeling are lost. In place of striving, there is luxury. In place of courage, there is cowardice. In place of personal strength, there are clients and followers. The dynasty becomes senile and breaks down. Today, the four Rockefeller brothers of the third generation are on the decline. They still command great resources, and their client followers are legion, but they are surely losing control. Their policies have already destroyed what our forefathers created, leaving the destiny of our land tied to the destiny of their dynasty. Now the Rockefeller dynasty is reaching the end of its natural life, and as it collapses, it is taking with it the hollow shell of what once was known as the United States of America. Topic number 3. When a civilization comes to an end, it does not mean the end of all life for those who made up that civilization. What it does mean is the end of a way of life. And that, my friends, is what lies ahead for those who survive the man-made calamity to come. 60 years ago, the Eastern Orthodox Christian civilization centered on Russia was thrown into a desperate battle for its life. Through that battle, it has itself been changed. We in the West do not view life from the perspective of 60 years of mortal combat for spiritual survival, so we would no doubt be shocked by some of the concepts of the new breed in today's Kremlin. The very, very important fact remains. Very powerful religious convictions are today a determining factor guiding the policies of Soviet Russia. In what country of the West can the same be said? The old-line Bolsheviks who seized Russia in 1917 were parasites, destructive in every respect. By contrast, the self-styled spiritual communists of the Kremlin today have a zeal to achieve bigger and better things for the glory of Mother Russia and, as they see it, for the glory of God. And once mankind is rid of the rabid disease of Bolshevism, the vistas they believe they see before them are breathtaking. Early in this century, the Russian discipline called cosmonautics was founded by a man named Tchaikovsky. At that time, space travel was so far in the future as to seem a fantastic dream. But Tsiolkovsky began his studies of cosmonautics with the dictum, quote, "The planet Earth is the cradle of mankind, but man cannot forever remain in the cradle," unquote. Today, American spacemen are called astronauts, Russian spacemen, cosmonauts, and the difference goes far deeper than the name. To the Western mind, space travel is mainly a stimulating technical challenge and an adventure, sort of a cosmic sporting event. But the Russians see it very differently. To them, space travel is the beginning of man's expansion outward into his new, larger habitat, the solar system, and someday the stars. Already this change of perspective is reflected in the Soviet cosmostrategy and cosmopolitics, which I described 4 months ago in Audio Letter 31. Kremlin planning for the exploration and occupation of space has already gone far beyond the immediate, narrowly military applications we see today. And in one respect, Russia's plans for man's first interplanetary empire harken back to ancient Rome. In the Roman Empire, conquered peoples became citizens of Rome, thereby sharing to some extent in the privileges and benefits the empire had to offer. And considerable autonomy was allowed in terms of local customs and religious practices, so long as they did not threaten or trouble Rome. Under the rule of those in the Kremlin today, the Soviet Union is beginning to do much the same thing. This has shown itself even in the program to begin expanding the Russian Empire into space. Several weeks ago, Soyuz 28 was sent into orbit with one Russian and one non-Russian cosmonaut, a Czech. 4 days ago, the second non-Russian cosmonaut, a Pole this time, flew into orbit aboard Soyuz 30. The crew of Soyuz 30 docked with the Salyut 6 space station and entered it to join the crew of Soyuz 29, who were already there. The commander of Soyuz 29, by the way, is the Russian Neil Armstrong, Vladimir Kovalinuk. As I revealed last October in Audio Letter 27, Kovalinuk was the commander of the first Soviet manned flight to the moon, which landed October 16, 1977, in Jules Verne crater on the backside of the moon. In the view of Russian cosmonautics, man will inevitably move outward from Earth to the planets and stars, and it is meant to do so. So the Russian approach to space travel gives very heavy emphasis to philosophical and psychological factors, as well as technical and physical training. Cosmonauts are taught to view the new environment of space as one that is a natural extension for man, but one requiring humility and caution. Part of the heritage of Russia is that of the seafaring Vikings of ages past. Today, a spiritual rebirth is dawning in Russia. The Russian spirit is being drawn upward and outward to the limitless seas of space. Western civilization will soon perish, but not the human spirit. Lest we forget, our Lord's mercy and justice are meant at least as much for those who have suffered for decades as it is for those of us who have yet to suffer. Until next month, God willing, this is Dr. Beter. Thank you. I may God bless each and every one of you.